Show.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! This is a pleasant change. We've gotten all the way through the week. Knock wood. Oh, Jesus, quickly. Wait a minute. I just want to make sure everybody knows I'm doing it right. That's real wood. That's no damn laminate. That's no plywood. I'm knocking wood. We've made it through. Stop it! We've made it through a 4 days of broadcasting, almost hitch-free. So that's a good sign, and that means that we come to this, the end of the week, nearly the end of the month of January. You know, I was looking at the snow piled nearly a foot deep outside, thinking, damn, and we've still got February yet to go. How? That was a little depressing when it dawned on me. It was, I gotta tell you. But we will get through it. We're almost done with January. 2 minutes past the hour. And I have good news for you. I have very, very good news for you. We're almost there. We will begin January of 2011 actually in the black, having made our monthly fundraising goal, if only 9 of you will step up tonight to the tune of $10 apiece. $90. $90. That's all we need. $90. And we are at our January fundraising goal. $90. 9 people. 9 people, $10 apiece. The $10, well, that works out to less than 5 cents an hour of programming for the month. Stunning, isn't it, when you consider it? Yes. So I consider that very good news. We should be able to do $90 in 3 hours' time. And then, Monday, I don't say a word about fundraising. Not a word. Not a peep. Not a tweet. Not a nothing. Cool? I think so. So we have made it to Friday. And it is Friday on the front porch. Well, okay, we'll come inside seeing how it's kind of cold and snowy. But we'll pass around a pot of tea or hot tea, something to warm you up, maybe a little slug of brandy or something, just something to get the heat going inside you. Then we can talk about a wide variety of things, but it's hard not to talk about the elephant in the room, and the elephant in the room is, of course, the unrest in Egypt. I have heard, Chris Matthews referred to the people protesting in the name of democracy as a mob. Thanks, you egalitarian bastard, you, Chris Matthews. A mob. Ah, well, there it is. Okay, $40, 4 people. One individual just said, I'll step up with $50 tonight. So that means only 4 of you have to step up with the other $40. There we go. Pretty cool, huh? Yeah, I thought so. But I've been glued to the coverage all day long of what's going on in Egypt. Many of you have as well. The hashtags for the Egypt coverage were flying by so fast, if you were following one of the hashtags, as to be unreadable. It was just, give up. And, of course, by now, Hosni Mubarak, I'm sure you know, has spoken to the Egyptian people. Oh, for God's sakes, Marty, no. Well, why am I not surprised? Yet Radio Rwanda called the protesters Al-Qaeda-linked. Why am I not surprised? Yeah, no friends of democracy over at Radio Rwanda. You know, Fox News. Mubarak has spoken to the people, but the question is, there was no way of knowing if it was live or Memorex, because one of the more interesting tweets I saw as I prepped for the show this evening was one that reported that Israeli sources, Israeli media, were reporting that Mubarak was on a plane bound for, where else? Switzerland. Because that's where the stuff that Mubarak really cares about is located, namely all the money that he's skimmed off the top, just slightly below the top, down into the middle and all the way off the bottom, and squirreled away in a secret bank account in Switzerland. I don't know. Is it possible? Because in the speech he said that he was still firmly in control and that he felt really bad about the economic conditions and he stood squarely with the poor and that it was all the other ministers' faults and he sacked them. But said that he wasn't going anywhere. See, this is where a knowledge of history comes in real handy. Because that's not exactly new. It was sometime, you know, the Ptolemies ruled Egypt from the time of Alexander the Great up until Cleopatra. She was the last Ptolemaic ruler of Egypt. And Octavian, who would later become known as Caesar Augustus, had to put her in a position where he could bump her off and claim that she was an enemy of Rome and a threat to Rome, so that he could consolidate power over the last remnants of the Roman Republic and transform it into authoritarian empire. And once he had done that, of course, we all know that Rome was never able to recover and lived in an authoritarian dictatorship for the remainder of its history. The difference being that some dictators were more benevolent than others. And it is that historical perspective, which you know that I am passionate about, it is that historical perspective that informs the way I look at things like what's going on in Egypt. And it's not the first time. Under the Ptolemies, they styled themselves as pharaohs, but they were Macedonian Greeks. You might recall, or not, that Cleopatra's grandfather, I believe it was, and we're talking about Cleopatra, the last Cleopatra. The Ptolemies had a bunch of Cleopatras. Cleopatra the 5th, the 6th, the 7th, yada, yada, yada. But it was the last Cleopatra, the one that made an asp of herself. It was the last Cleopatra who was actually the granddaughter of Mithridates the Great of Pontus, who caused the Romans no end of trouble in the last waning years of the Republic, and was ultimately put down by a succession of generals, that among them Sulla and Pompey Magnus, Pompey the Great. But in that time, the Ptolemies had a taste for two things: incest and murder. And usually the victims of murder were the same people that would, if they survived, become the practitioners of incest. The Ptolemies had to marry sister-brother in order to rule Egypt. Cleopatra got around it a little bit by offing both of her brothers, having a child by Julius Caesar, and then naming young Caesarion as her regent. Octavian, later Caesar Augustus, had Caesarion killed out of hand as quickly as possible, because he was deemed a threat to Rome, because he was said to have been the very spit and image of Julius Caesar. Look just like him. Look just like his daddy. That's how, you know, that's how they are. But in amongst those Ptolemies, there was a practice. And that practice was to, at the first sign of trouble, ditch the ministers. Really? In the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, it says there is nothing new under the sun, and it is true. What is being played out in the streets of Cairo and in the streets of Alexandria is not new. It has been going on for, millennia, more or less. The religion changed from the old ways of the Egyptian worship of Isis and Osiris and Hathor and Taqueret and Anubis and the rest of that pantheon. There was a brief period of time where the Greek gods were brought in by the Ptolemies, being Macedonian Greeks. Coptic Christianity took hold for a little while, but then everything changed in the 7th century A.D. when Islam, the host of Muhammad, overran Egypt and converted it majority converted it to Islam. But some of the dynamics don't change. And among those dynamics is that the surest way to have everything go straight to hell in a handbasket is to not feed the people. Famine was something that ran through Egypt from the earliest days of the Pharaonic kingdoms in the land of Chem. They called themselves the land of Chem, K-E-M. They did not call themselves Egypt. That was a Greek word and a Romanized word that was applied to that corner of the world. But when you don't feed the people, things get bad. And the first people to begin complaining are the people who live on the barest fringe of society. And Egypt's poor have not hesitated to protest and take to the streets whenever they felt they were being ill-treated. In the days of the pharaohs, literally every human being that existed up and down the kingdom of the Nile were literally the property of the pharaohs. Pharaoh owned everything, save for that which was controlled by the priests. The priestly class propped up the pharaoh, and the pharaoh propped up the priestly class. It was a wholly symbiotic relationship. But when famine stalked the land, everyone was in danger. And that is why tonight, during Mubarak's either live or Memorex address, that is why he appealed to the people who were not yet protesting. He appealed to the people who owned property. He appealed to what passes for a middle class inside the land of Chem to stay out of the streets, to not back the poor who were protesting, to not back those who had already taken to the streets. And that was for very good reason. Hosni Mubarak has not managed to keep control of Egypt for 30 years by being some dummy. He has been a brutal dictator. I don't care what Vice President Joe Biden said when he was taking the mud and snow tires off the Trans Am. He is a brutal dictator. His prisons overrun with political prisoners. No less so than did the Bastille in Paris in the latter portions of the 18th century. Mubarak's political prisoners are legion, and they are there for any number of a variety of offenses, real or perceived. The greatest offense being that being deemed a threat
to the security of the state. And that covers a whole lot of potential offenses. As noted on the program last night or the night before, it was an Egyptian physician named Ayman al-Zawahiri who became somewhat radicalized and was mistreated by the Mubarak regime, who went on, because of that mistreatment, to be further radicalized and became second or third or fourth or God only knows what in command to Osama bin Laden. Right? Yeah. So, you get an idea, or you get a little bit of a picture via history that this is not new. The hungry rioted against Cleopatra. The disaffected citizenry of Alexandria had no problem rioting against all of the Ptolemies whenever they fed, and would take Ptolemies out into the street and rip them limb from limb and into tiny pieces. And if, it's hard not to note that the concerned third party watching at a distance in the ancient world was Rome, because Rome was unable to feed itself and relied upon the lush and green and fertile fields left by the inundations of the Nile, the rising Nile, to feed a population that itself would get rather cranky when it got hungry. And we find ourselves watching from afar, not because we get our food from Egypt, but because we rely upon Egypt to be a counterbalance to the rest of the Muslim world in maintaining an uneasy peace with the nation in the Middle East that wags us like a tail wagging a dog, and we know what that nation is. It was easier in the olden days. You just posted, you bashed a few heads, you slit a few throats, you gut stabbed with those handy little short swords the Romans had. They were called gladii, and then people had a way of settling down. Caesar nearly met his end at the hands of one of those cranky mobs, since we're calling them mobs because that's what Chris Matthews called them. But we watch today as well, because we are the United States has propped up Hosni Mubarak and all of his excesses for 30 years, deeming that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And Egypt, by virtue of the brutal repression of all things Islamically fundamentalist, has been deemed our friend. How much of our friend? All those vehicles you saw running up and down the street, a few of them getting overturned and burned and so forth, you paid for those. Did you realize that? You did. You paid for those. You paid for the armored personnel carriers. You paid for the tanks. You've paid for the helicopters. You have paid for the troop carriers, the vehicles with the water cannon on them. You have paid for every bit of it. Because the United States sends something on the order of $1.5 billion. $1.5 billion. $1,500 million. Every year. To the brutal dictatorial regime of Hosni Mubarak. Or would it be more properly pronounced Mubarak? Uh-oh, can't have that sounding like no Barack, or the teabaggers and the right-wingers will start going crazy and ordering birth certificates from Hawaii for all they're worth. But that's where we find ourselves, wondering if the United States is going to get it wrong again, whether we will respond as Harry Truman did in the yearnings for peace by the Iranian people, in which he refused to bow to the will of Winston Churchill and suppress the democratic urges of the Iranian people. Truman didn't. Eisenhower later did. Or whether we will do it like we did Chile. Understand something. For those of you who say, well, there's no difference between Barack Obama and George W. Bush. He's just Bush light. Understand something. If this was the George W. Bush administration, the phone would have already been picked up, and W. would have been straight on the phone to Mubarak going, hey, Hosni. I'm going to call you Hosehead. Hey, Hosehead. Why ain't you cracking some skulls real big time? Hey, put down the sticks and the damn tear gas and start mowing them little brown bastards down. They don't understand nothing but force. Get with it. You do understand that if this was a Republican regime, John McCain and Sarah Palin or George W. Bush, you do understand that the blood would be running knee-deep through the streets of Cairo and Alexandria right now. Don't you? Because it would be. There have been some missteps by the Obama administration, primarily missteps by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, but they have not been in such a way as to tend toward encouraging the brutal repression of the protesting thousands and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. It's along the lines of what I said last night. We live in an age of empire. We tease ourselves into thinking that what happens every 4 years in November represents some degree of self-government. And to a minuscule degree, it does. But regardless of who wins, they come into an imperial government. And imperial governments are authoritarian and fundamentally fascistic in nature. Go through history and find me an empire that wasn't. Democracy was born in ancient Athens. And yet, by the time it began feeling its oats, it had put itself together a little empire and began to feel froggy enough to take on the Spartans and got the Peloponnesian War going real good, and the next thing you know, all vestiges of Athenian democracy were gone, baby. Gone. Over. Done. Right? Yeah. So that by the time Alexander comes along, any pretense of democracy is not worth talking about. Rome never came back from empire. Britain never came back from empire. Japan, Germany, even the paltry, halting attempts at empire of Mussolini's Italy did not willingly come back from being empire. It's impossible. It's just impossible. And so it is that we find ourselves selecting presidents who will become president of the empire of the United States. And you do get a choice every 4 years. You get a choice between Caligula and Marcus Aurelius. You get a choice between Nero and Vespasian. You get a choice between Tiberius and Hadrian. You get a choice between open brutality or a leader with some degree of empathy for the lower reaches of society, who will at least throw a few crumbs. That's all, though. That is all. Agnes looked at me earlier today and said, you know, in our lifetime, what you're watching in Egypt will come to the U.S. And I said, forget it. The United States, the people of the United States don't have it in them. And we don't. We don't. We just don't. Never have. Ever. Why? Because the government is set up in such a way to discourage that kind of behavior, one. And two, there are enough creature comforts for everyone in this country, all the way down to practically the poorest of the poor, whether it be a bottle or a rock of crack or a little bit of meth. There are enough creature comforts in this country to make sure that nobody feels like they really ought to put themselves out for anything. Not 10 years from now, not 25, not 50, not 100, will what we see in Egypt happen in the United States. And I caution those of you who think you would like to see it happen. The only time it came close to happening was in the Civil War era, when the draft riots took place in New York. They were not handled gently. The Civil War itself was the only time that we really got serious about it, and that was only because a gang of patrician white Southerners was willing to use the blood, bones, sinew, gristle, guts, and lives themselves of the poor whites that they had been abusing for generations to march into cannon and rifle fire in order to maintain, hopefully, the right to continue to own human flesh of darker skin. I'm not saying it cannot happen here. I am saying it will not happen here. Egypt, as we noted today, has an internet and cell phone kill switch. You think one of those doesn't exist here, too? Good God, it was only a couple of years ago that Guy James and I were on the streets of D.C. the night of the inauguration. And that wasn't even hostile or threatening. But the cell service in Washington, D.C. couldn't handle a phone call just because so many people were on the system. I don't know if the government needs a kill switch. But there's a problem that extends to the United States' position on Egypt that sort of negates whatever official position the government might take. No matter how measured a response we have, no matter how much we appeal for calm, we have un-American, America-hating organizations out there actively working against the government of we the people. As mentioned on the program last night, the United States Chamber of Commerce's Egyptian affiliate, the AmCham of Egypt, was told to get busy and stand side by side and shoulder to shoulder with the dictatorial regime of Hosni Mubarak. Think Progress reporting AmCham Egypt's relation to the Mubarak dictatorship stretches back decades. In fact, the Egyptian dictator even personally intervened to create the organization. Oh, look. In 1988, Hosni Mubarak issued an order to allow for the creation of the AmCham by giving it an exemption from Egypt's strict NGO laws, which help limit the influence human rights and democracy promotion organizations might otherwise have. Since then, the AmCham of Egypt has grown to have hundreds of members, while roughly 75% of the organization's members are Egyptian businesses. Many of them are also large Western multinational corporations like Coca-Cola and BP. All told, the member companies of the AmCham Egypt account for nearly 20% of the entirety of the gross domestic product of Egypt. Think Progress says, as Al Masra Al Yum, a major Egyptian paper, reports, the Mubarak regime tapped AmCham Egypt President Shafik Gabr to do its bidding. Gabr was dispatched expressly for the purpose of scuttling a bill that called on the government of Egypt to end crackdowns on pro-democracy activists and hold free and fair elections. How about that? So at the same time, the U.S. government says that it appeals for calm. The dictatorship is being propped up by transnational and multinational corporations at the bidding of the United States Chamber of Commerce. One step forward, two step back. Recently, just before the protests began in Egypt, AmCham Egypt hosted former U.S. Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte. Oh, look, there's a name we recognize, isn't there? John Negroponte was feted by the Egypt AmCham. And you know, just as a matter of history, that whither John Negroponte goes, bloodshed follows. Really. Whether it be Iraq, or Central America, or anywhere else on the planet, he sets his blood-sodden boot. In delivering an address, Negroponte said it will be crucial for U.S. interests to continue to support our friends in the region, such as Egypt, Jordan, and Gulf countries. Asked about what happened in Tunisia, Negroponte said, you know, one of those famous moments of not getting it right. He said what happened in Tunisia is not necessarily transferable to other countries. Depends on the word, what the word necessarily means, I guess. He blamed the news media for sensational coverage of self-immolation protests in Egypt, Algeria, and Mauritania, and urged a little bit of patience. Let's hope the country doesn't descend into chaos. Chaos is in no one's interest. John Negroponte sits on the board of Agility DGS. That's a defense contractor that has major operations in Egypt. So there's that. There's also this. Another little moment, another little entity that makes the likelihood of American government policy, official State Department policy, official Obama administration policy, less likely to be effective. You know how they flipped the kill switch in internet and turned off the internet and turned off the cell phones and turned off the everything today? Well, guess how that happened? Yeah, you know already, right? Timothy Carr, writing in Huffington Post and reprinted at Common Dreams, notes that the tools that connect us together on the internet and organize and empower protesters can also be used to hunt them down. He refers, of course, to Telecom Egypt, the nation's dominant phone and internet service provider. Mr. Carr notes that it is a state-run enterprise. And it was through that state-run enterprise that it became easy on Friday morning in Egypt for authorities to pull the plug and plunge much of the nation into digital darkness. Much as the Bush administration developed the ability to spy domestically on American citizens, the Egyptian dictatorship has the same ability, with maybe slightly fewer actual impediments to doing so. They're able to open communications packets and read their contents. Mr. Carr notes that it was the same method during 2009 that Iran used to disappear hundreds, if not thousands, of cyber dissidents inside that country. And you don't just have the ability to do that kind of thing. That is a function of software and massive computing power. In this case, real-time intelligence equipment has been provided to the Egyptian government at great cost, subsidized, of course, by you and me, by an American firm by the name of Narus, N-A-R-U-S, Narus, an American corporation in Sunnyvale, California. Narus is presently owned by Boeing, but it was founded in 1997 by Israeli security experts to create and sell mass surveillance systems for governments and large corporate clients. Their signature, well, the gem of their product line is something called Narus Insight, which is in fact a supercomputer system that even our own National Security Agency uses to do mass surveillance and monitoring of public and corporate internet communications in real time. Egypt Telecom gets its deep packet inspection equipment from Narus, as well as content filtering technology that lets network managers inspect, track, and target content from users of the internet and mobile phones as it passes through routers on the information superhighway. Pakistan and Saudi Arabia also do business with Narus. Steve Bannerman is Narus's marketing vice president, and he boasted to Wired magazine once online, "Anything that comes through an internet protocol network, we can record. We can reconstruct all of their emails along with attachments, see what web pages they clicked on. We can reconstruct their voice over internet protocol calls." So just remember, when that switch was flipped in Egypt to turn off the internet and the cell phone communication in Egypt, it was done with the help of an American corporation from Sunnyvale, California, that despises freedom. Nice, huh? So that's where we begin. We certainly have a lot more other things to go into this evening, but of course you know that. You always know that. It is the nature of the program. Friday on the Front Porch, you can offer, bring to the table whatever it is you wish to bring. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Follow the Moskwa down to Gorky Park, listening to the wind of change. August summer night, soldiers passing by, listening to the wind of change. That we could be so close, like brothers. The future's in the air, can feel it everywhere. I'm blowing with the wind of change. Take me
Let's stop. Darn, that was so moving. And then we get Twisted Sister. No, that was the Scorpions and Winds of Change. And they do continue to blow, don't they? But you have to understand why it is. And the lines are open, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. You got to understand why somebody like Vice President Joe Biden says what he says. Andy in Redwood City just sent this in. He says, what's up with this comment? Vice President Joe Biden offered his take on the protests in Egypt, saying the current protests should not cause Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak to resign, speaking in response to a question from NewsHour's Jim Lehrer. And Andy adds, as you said, we have a real semi-fascist regime in the White House. Joe Biden was the emissary for the credit card industry. He let them write the bankruptcy bill. Then he submitted it. Remember the bankruptcy bill? Yeah, the one that reformed bankruptcy on the backs of people who'd had their lives turned upside down by medical disaster and wound up, you know, losing things like it. And they fixed it so you couldn't bankrupt credit cards anymore, which were always unsecured debt before. Yeah, that bankruptcy bill. MBNA Corporation, one of the largest credit card companies based in Delaware, had him in their back pocket. MBNA Corp, now Bank of America, bankrolled Joe Biden for years. Like Obama, he's a corporate hack that has no problem going to bat for the corporate elite. This is his instinct, his natural reaction to support dictators and tyrants, as well as corporate CEOs. He's an overrated corporate hack. I understand he is just part of the fascist empire, just another piece of human waste and detritus that it produces, which couldn't give a rat's ass about the people on the ground here. Thanks and keep up the great work, says Andy. And, you know, I really do urge, because it's the best long-term view of empire that we have, I really do urge a working understanding of Rome. I know, you probably get tired of me geeking on and on and on about Rome, but I'm not going to stop. Because I'm not saying that that it's a direct one-to-one correlation. It isn't. But there are lessons to be learned. Now that we're here, now that the era of the American Republic is clearly over, the question is, what kind of emperor do you want? Don't be fooled for a minute into thinking that because they're only around for 4 or 8 years, that they're not emperors. Lord God knows, with the security apparatus we have around them, it's everything short of a Praetorian cohort. save for the fact that the cohort hasn't yet decided it feels froggy enough to take them out and replace them with others. Recall that it was Caligula who was offed by the Praetorian Guard, and Claudius was then put in to succeed him. And Claudius proved to be considerably more enlightened than Caligula, because Caligula was mad as a March hare following some illness, after which he figured he decided he was a living god. But even stuff like living gods, you know, we look at that and go, well, that's nutty. It wasn't for that era. It wasn't. As I've noted before, there were statues of Caesar, there were statues of Augustus, there were statues of Mark Antony and Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus, all over, especially in what the Romans called the East, that referred to them as a living God, God among us, Savior of common humanity. They were not unusual. Cleopatra did the Isis get up because she was God on earth. She was the living incarnation of Isis. It wasn't, and to a certain extent, from a more secular standpoint, we do the same with the president. And God knows the right wing nobody's better than the fundamentalist evangelical right wing at setting up false gods with their little prayer breakfast and their national day of prayer for the president. You notice that those things kind of dried up and blew away after George left, because them evangelicals, they don't want to be praying for no brown-skinned, fascist, communist, Kenyan Muslims. But it is an important choice that we make. Do we want an emperor with a little bit of enlightenment about him, a Marcus Aurelius, a Hadrian, a Vespasian? Or do we want Caligula and Nero and Galba and Otho and Tiberius, all of whom were more or less manifestations, avatars of what we would recognize in George W. Bush 2,000 years later? Joe Biden doesn't want Hosni Mubarak to leave office because Hosni Mubarak is the devil that we know. And far better, from an imperial standpoint, the devil you know than the devil you don't. Because the way institutionalized government views popular revolutions is that you don't know what's going to come bobbing to the surface and take control. Witness the Russian Revolution. There were several upheavals before the Bolsheviks got control. And what did the United States government do? Actively moved to try to strangle the Bolshevik Revolution in its cradle, rather than trying to work with it. Witness what we have done to the Cuban people for 50 years now. Cuban people who never had anything against us in the first place, who looked to us as a bastion of freedom. And we spat on them by trying to choke them to death economically. We have waged an economic war on the Cuban people for 50 years. Because they chose a leader not of our liking. Therein, again, Fulgencio Batista was the devil we knew, just as Hosni Mubarak is, just as the Saudi royal family is, just as the last remnants of the Hashemites in Amman, Jordan are. The devil we know. We are scared to death of Islamic fundamentalism. We're scared to death of Egypt becoming a failed state. 80 million, the largest Muslim nation in the so-called Arab world. We get real nervous about that, because we've got business there. And after all, as Calvin Coolidge said,
The business of America is business. Not freedom. Not democracy. Not conscience. The business of America is business. And Jim asks a question of similar import. And what will happen should the current regime in Egypt be overthrown? Another Islamic fundamentalist nation inimical to the already delicate peace in the Middle East. Like it or not, autocracies and empires have their place in history and have made serious contributions in science, art, and literature. Think about it. But they have always done so on the backs of the poor and the downtrodden. To see the Flavian Amphitheater in Rome is to see a monument to empire. But it was built with the labor of the poor. To tour the White House in Washington, D.C. is to tour a lovely structure that was built with slave labor. There's no guarantee that the Egyptian regime would be replaced by an Islamic fundamentalist one, because there is a very strong secular streak through the Egyptian society that does not exist, cannot exist in wholly fascist monarchies like Saudi Arabia, or that benign despot in Bahrain, or Dubai. Autocracies and empires, I agree with Jim, have their place in history. And the place that they occupy in history is drenched in human blood. Awash in it. And nothing that empire and autocracy ever accomplished in human history outweighs the blood in which it was soaked. The Palace of Versailles, the Great Pyramid, the pyramids of Mesoamerica and Central America, the temple at Angkor Wat, the Great Wall of China, were all monuments to folly, to greed, to avarice. And those monsters of folly and greed and avarice, those demons were fed on human flesh. It just is. Marty noting, "Oh hell, Bob, the tear gas used in Egypt are made in America. At least we're making something." That's the last American manufacturing that we have, is crap to kill brown people with somewhere else. Yeah, I've got a nice email in from Michael in Norway that I want to make sure I get to here in a little bit, and I will, but I hate to keep people waiting. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Hey, Tony, what's up?
I'm good. Before we get started, let me just give you a little praise. You sure know your history.
well, that's what I was learning when I wasn't learning anything useful.
No, I'm serious, man, because you pretty much laid it all out. And today, especially, I mean, you came out of the gates fast. You really threw the gauntlet down on this one. This is going to be one of your, not all of your shows are great, but this is going to be one of your great ones, I think, because you definitely rose the bar a little bit. So.
I guess it's a function, Tony, not to pat myself on the back, but it's a function of watching, professional journalists all day long who don't have a God blessed idea of the cultural soil from which this stuff springs, from which it sprouts. Egypt is an ancient culture with an ancient memory. In terms of Egypt, the Muslim conquest of the 7th century, well, that happened yesterday.
Yeah.
The Great Pyramid is about the halfway point through the culture. There's still thousands of years before that.
Yeah, you're definitely.
You know, they were engaging in some level, brewing beer and making bread and shaving their heads. I mean, to come up with something sharp enough to shave your head so you don't have to get eaten alive by the lice, that is a technological advancement in and of itself. And they were doing that when my forebears were still wrestling with the weasels over what the vultures didn't want.
The weasels. That's a great line. I'm going to put that on his shirt.
I mean, I just have a real hard time feeling culturally superior, having come from white European stock, when I realize how long civilization's been going somewhere else.
That's true. Are you familiar with Mosaic and Link TV?
Only by reference. It certainly isn't on my two tin cans and a string cable system here.
Okay, now I didn't say this, but if you go on iTunes, you can get the podcast. I've been watching the basic concept of the channel is they do like a 30-minute broadcast of the day, and they get stories all from the Middle East. And obviously, the number one story has been going on is what's happening in Egypt. And I've been watching their podcast today because it's live video, which you can't see over here. And this guy, what's his name again? I want to say president or prime minister. What is he? Mubarak.
President Hosni Mubarak.
Yeah, President Hosni Mubarak. I'm sorry. He's still there right now. You said they might fly him to Switzerland, or is he?
Well, no, I don't know if he's there or not. I mean, that's the thing. You didn't know if it was taped or if it was live or anything, because even the translation was secondary. For instance, the Al Jazeera translation was much more coherent. The CNN apparently got a 13-year-old little girl off the street who had 2 years of English to do the translation. It was awful. But the translations were secondary. They weren't state-supplied. So that thing could have been taped 8 hours ago and just run right now that Mubarak's on the ground in Switzerland. We simply don't know. I mean, I only saw one mention of it, that Israeli media was reporting that he was gone to Switzerland.
Here's a question for you. And these lazy reporters won't ask it, but the answer to this question will say everything. A, where are they getting the equipment to fire beat back the protesters? And B, if he did fly out, was he flown out on a Blackwater plane? And did they provide security? Because if they did, that answers everything.
No, he wouldn't have to be. He's got his own gig.
But you understand what I'm saying, though.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Blackwater or somebody there, you know, maybe he's got his own gig, but if they provided extra security, then that.
No, he didn't need Blackwater. Okay. He's got his own little close cadre of skullcrackers, armed to the teeth.
Where did they get trained? See what I'm saying?
Sure.
Yeah, you understand what I mean.
Well, but, you know, and where did all the munitions and weapons and everything come from? You paid for them, Tony. You paid for them.
Bingo. And another thing, you better have history of this than I am, but the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Ayman al-Zahiri's pet project, where are those guys? I mean, if
Well, they have come into the mix, supposedly, today.
Bingo, I knew it. And Ayman, if you believe all this stuff, him and his boys are just sitting back and waiting. Because when all this collapses, if it does, they're going to try to make their presence felt, for lack of a better word. You know what I mean?
I absolutely do. But there's no reason for them to come out and lead anything. What you do is you wait for the chaos to blossom full, and then you step into the vacuum, or you let it go through a few incarnations. And then you step up later on, much as was the case with the Bolsheviks in Russia in 1917.
That's what I'm talking about. But what did Joe Biden say? He praised the guy. Joe Biden actually said he's a great.
Well, no, he just said there's no need for him to step down.
How many times are we going to go through this? The Shah of Iran, Saddam Hussein, Hamid Karzai. I mean, when are we going to learn? This stuff, we back the wrong guy, and every 20 years it blows up in our face. You would think we would learn by now.
But see, and that's why I think a working knowledge of Roman history is handy, because we back the guy who does what we want. The Romans, for instance, installed Herod on the throne of Judea. Yeah. Now, they trimmed the province down to next to nothing. But they gave Herod the throne, and the Jewish people didn't like Herod because they didn't deem him properly Jewish, because one's Jewishness translates through the maternal line and not through the paternal. And his mother was some sort of northernish Arab.
Okay.
So he never had any kind of legitimacy, and he wound up having to spend the rest of his life killing his entire family.
Wow. Can I ask you something about, you were talking about Radio Rwanda. They said that the mob was Al-Qaeda linked.
Yeah, that's what Marty reported.
Those guys, my cats are Al-Qaeda.
Right, yeah, I mean, you know, Captain Crunch is an Al-Qaeda terrorist with Al-Qaeda secret decoder rings in every box.
And Captain Jack Sparrow runs a sleeper cell. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Bingo.
They'll find Al-Qaeda anywhere. I'm interested to see what happens if they do put this guy out. Here's another thing that might show you what's going on. If they get rid of this guy, which if it happens and they have elections, care to guess what color will be on the fingertips of this vote? Either it'll be blue or it might be a different color. I mean, think about it. Because I think maybe like a pastel might be good, or I don't know, maybe black. Because, you know, can you imagine if they have the gall to run the same kind of election where they hold up a finger again? I wonder if the American public would buy that.
Oh, the American public didn't buy it the first time through. The only people who bought that were the loyal Bushies.
Yeah, that's true. I'm going to change the subject for a second, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
Did you see Glenn Beck on TV with the bunny and the chainsaw?
No. You know, I think I've mentioned in the past, I make every conceivable effort not to. Our buddy Angelo, otherwise known as Stop Beck on Twitter, our buddy Angelo's out there, and he watches it so I don't have to.
He actually had a bunny, you know, a full live bunny rabbit, which he was petting.
And sharp, nasty teeth, right.
Yeah. And a chainsaw. And for a moment, you were thinking, no, is he really going to do this? He didn't, but that boy's warm, because it made it look like, anyway.
Oh, no, he's crazy as 4 o'clock.
I mean, it made it look like he was going to actually take the chainsaw to the rabbit. I don't know, that was kind of strange. And I can't believe Fox let him get away with it, but...
Hassan, definitely.
Okay, so, how do you think this is going to turn out, this whole Egyptian thing? What do you think is going to happen?
I'm not real comfortable in the prognosticating role here, Tony.
Okay.
I think it depends on... I think you can make a few projections. The harder Mubarak cracks down, the more the protests are going to ramp up. He is going, and the thing is, he may back himself into a corner where if he orders the army, remember the military was called out today, not just the police, but the protesters welcomed the military, we're told. We're glad to see them. Because the police are sort of deemed to be Mubarak's personal skullcrackers. Whereas the military, I guess, they answer to Mubarak, but they're not necessarily deemed to be quite as dangerously, fanatically loyal.
In other words,
and the question will come if Mubarak finds it necessary to issue orders to fire on Egyptian citizens. If the military takes that order and accepts it and follows it, it's going to be bad ugly.
In other words, the military has a conscience.
If they do, right. And there are open questions as to whether the military would follow such an order.
And like if you were a member of the military and you were told to fire on the crowd, you may see your brother in the crowd. You may see your sister. You may see your mother.
Right, because the military is a much broader cross section of Egyptian society.
Yeah, you're really going to fire. That's like you're really going to fire on your you might see your cousin or your neighbor. You're really going to fire on your neighbor or your cousin. That makes sense. You know, I never thought about that, but you're right. They would probably side with the people because like the government's really not doing anything for them except they're getting what they are, but they're not going to fire on their own citizens. That would make sense. I never thought about that, but you're right on that one.
But I think that will be telling. The other question that has to be answered is Mohammed al-Baradei.
Okay.
you know, he landed in Egypt. He went to Friday prayers and was met by the police and said, "You're going nowhere. Don't go anywhere. Don't say anything."
How does that?
Because Mohammed al-Baradei has clearly cast his lot with the anti-government forces, and he's very high visibility by virtue of his position on the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Oh, so they don't want him to go back.
Mubarak is there to form a government. I mean, al-Baradei is there to form a government.
Okay, I see what you mean.
I mean, that, and frankly, that was Hosni Mubarak's the oh shit moment.
Oh, man. So,
and he's being held under house arrest.
That's not good.
And that's main. And I submit that that's probably why the internet and wireless telephony was shut down, because they didn't want him in particular issuing any marching orders.
Oh, of course. Hey, getting back to this internet kill thing. Okay, I'm not trying to change the subject. I'm sorry about that. This Comcast thing. Are you nervous? I mean, how it's gonna affect your shows and everything else? Do you really think that they would actually pull a kill switch on the internet? I mean, because if that happens,
well, there has been legislation in Congress to enable one of those kill switches.
Does that make you nervous at all?
Sure, it does. This what I've been doing here for more than 5 years now has not been a hobby. I've poured more of my heart and my soul, to the extent that I have a soul. I've poured more of my heart and soul into this than I have anything else I've ever done in my life.
Because this is...
Now, Comcast doesn't directly affect me, Tony, because I'm not on Comcast. You know, I have enough problems as it is with the two dented tomato cans and a string internet service provider Frontier that is the last leg of the connection into the studio here. We had untold problems with that over the last couple of months. Well, year. It's been going on for over a year. What I worry about is the people that have Comcast who might not be able to get the program by virtue of some action of Comcast.
So, getting back to what we're talking about, when are these reporters going to start asking hard questions? Because it seems like, you know, like I said before, you're only going to, nobody really, I don't speak Arabic, you don't speak Arabic, and when you hear these things, they translate it, and you really don't know what they're saying. And like,
right, that's where a guy like Matt Osborne, our buddy Matt Osborne at Osborne Inc., OSBORNEINK.com, comes in.
Oh, yeah?
Because, you know, he's a veteran. And he was trained as an Arabic translator.
Oh, cool!
So I don't know if he can listen and translate on the fly, but he can probably pick up a noun and a verb here and there.
Well, he's definitely somebody you'd want to probably talk to about this, because he probably, like I said before, like when we get, I'm only bringing this name up so you can understand what I'm saying. Like when they used to show up in those Bin Laden tapes, right? And he was talking, and you hear Arabic, and they translated for you. The average public had no idea what he was talking about. They just
he may have been repeating "Mary had a little lamb," but by God, the CIA was sure that that was code for death to America.
But when they played it on TV, right, and they showed it to people, and then they would translate it. Come on, man, you had no idea what he was talking about. They were like,
"No,
oh, okay, I guess." And they just took the government's word for it. Anyway, I hate bringing this guy up, but it's a name that everybody knows, and that's why I bring it up, and I'm just trying to make a point. Anyway, Bob, you're on fire tonight. Keep going, man. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, brother. You have a good weekend, Tony.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Calling from Vegas, that's our buddy, Tony. Hey, welcome to the program.
If I wanted to take you out of context when you said, "These are the winds of change" by the Scorpions, and they do blow, I would put that on the Scorpions message board, and they would be completely riled up.
That's because you're vicious, and I know.
And you know, but it is funny you're playing that, because the Scorpions, it's their last album this year. So
how about that?
Yeah,
segueing into "I Want to Rock" by Twisted Sister didn't do me any good, though. It just kind of ruined the whole damn moment.
Yeah, that didn't.
Yeah, thanks, Bill Gates.
Yeah, I think Agnes is right about the uprising coming to America. Now, let me tell you why. I think the more and more these images flash on the TV of things that are unobtainable to average Americans, the more and more the anger in the sea is going to rise up. Now, the rural areas, I think, will be fine. But the big cities, Bob, the big cities are going to be another thing entirely. And when they find out that the only jobs, little by little as it drips out, when they find out the only jobs are going to be in retail and food service and some low IT tech department jobs that are probably aren't even going to be six figures, things are going to happen really quick. And I'm going to tell you this, Bob, and this is for everybody to understand this. When you suddenly realize that that's all you have, and those images on, and this is why the TV and advertising in this world is dangerous. Because when those images keep flashing by, and they are going to keep flashing, of all the stuff that no one is going to be able to buy, no one's going to be able to put their money down, they're just going to be see it from a distance. And I'll tell you why, Bob. Because that's what happens in the ghetto, people. When people go on the streets and they come out of prison or they're in high school and they see someone rolling by and they're constantly just flashing what they have, there's always someone who steps up to rob that person. We are headed for that in a way we've never seen before. And like I said, the big cities are going to be a problem. The rural areas, not so much. But man, the advertising, when you go to New York, when you go to New York, people, like I said, when I went to New York, I went to a club that cost me $100 to get in. Someone paid for me. I witnessed a guy pay $1,000 to sit on a chair and not face the audience. I witnessed it myself. And that's when I knew we were in more trouble than anyone realized.
Well, let's go back for a minute. And examine the likelihood of any sort of American uprising.
Oh, it's going to happen.
Nah. Because we had the Great Depression here. All right? We had the Great Depression and massive unemployment and massive unrest. And all there was in the way of mass communication was radio and newspapers. Okay?
Yeah.
No Twitter, no Facebook, no TV, no satellite. There was nothing really to distract the American people and keep them happily ensconced in their chairs. There were no Kardashian sisters. There was no Piers Morgan with a canned interview tonight on CNN of Colin Firth. Really, really. With when you consider the time difference, what is it, 7-8 hours between... between the Eastern time zone and Egypt, at roughly 5 a.m. Egypt time, CNN is going to be airing a canned interview between Piers Morgan and Colin Firth. Really. That's, Jesus. But anyway, none of that existed in the Great Depression, and it didn't happen then. The Bonus Army marched. That was about it. There were, there was discontent. There were people riding the rails. There were people out of work, desperate. The Socialist Party tried to, tried to get a foothold. Huey Long preached a brand of what would be deemed a sort of socialism that was quietly co-opted by FDR and the Democrats and made banal and bland and palatable to a large segment of the American population. And the American population stayed right where they are. Now, fast forward to today, David. You've got a cable channel for every possible interest under the sun. You've got a cable channel for people who want to watch guys shoot deer. You've got a cable channel for people who want to watch talentless people make asses of themselves. There's probably 6 or 8 of those channels, really. You've got channels where you can sit quietly and watch the news and be spoon-fed somebody's idea of what you're supposed to think, regardless of whether it's CNN, MSNBC, CNBC, or Radio Rwanda. You've got the standard fare programming of CBS, ABC, and Fox. You've got HBO. You've got Showtime. You've got Cinemax. You've got everything. You've got every possible means of manipulating the American consciousness that there is. And even if the cable goes off, there is still, for a vast majority of the American people, there's still over-the-air television. It ain't going to happen. It is not going to happen. Because even with the protests for the Iraq War, which were massive, the protests against the Iraq War in 2003, massive affairs all over the world, you could barely get the news outlets to cover them because it was deemed not in their best interest, and they were doing the bidding of the empire. And of course, those protests then just dried up and blew away, and it was as if they never were. Among other things, the geography of the United States militates against any sort of mass uprising. The only thing that changes anything in the United States is a massive natural disaster, and I mean massive. I'm not talking, it would make Katrina look like a walk in the park. Humongous, you know, something like a massive earthquake along the New Madrid Fault that would destroy everything south of Minneapolis all the way to the Gulf, something like that. An eruption of the supervolcano under Yellowstone. A humongous earthquake that makes the last San Francisco one back during the World Series look like nothing. Or something near enough to have a direct impact on the American life. But political unrest, it isn't going to happen. As Chris Hedges noted, we have gone past any possibility of that, and we're now living in the twin realities of both 1984 and Brave New World. And when the Brave New World soporifics don't work, the 1984 crackdown damn sure does.
Well, that's an opinion. And my opinion is, and Agnes seems to think that too, and a lot of people seem to think that Bob, a lot of these people right now in this country do not have that much to live for. They do not have that much to live for. And it's going to continue to get worse for them. So when you say there's not going to be an uprising, I'm not saying the whole country is going to be an uprising. And then there is that, and then there is an image and a visual that goes along with it. And the visual that I have probably isn't the visual that you have when it comes to an uprising. But there will be, there is going to be chaos in areas of the cities. And I'll say this also.
Well, I won't disagree with you that there will be isolated incidents.
No.
Let me finish real quick. The problem, though, is that, or not the problem, but the reality is that we have an attenuated governmental structure. So that if you're mad at Washington, it doesn't do you much good to go down and protest in front of City Hall. You got to go to Washington, and if you go to Washington, that's a whole lot of money. Depending on where you live in the country.
Well, here's how I would counter that. There's going to be the rise of vigilante gangs block to block to block. It already happens in the ghettos. You would be surprised at some of these videos out there, Bob, with 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds controlling at least 12 or 13 blocks with disciples in each chapter and the craziest motherfuckers you've ever seen in your life.
Oh, David, that's different from saying that, you know, there's going to be Egypt-style unrest in the United States. I don't deny the reality of what you're describing. I'm familiar with some of it. There's plenty of places in the United States where the cops won't go. But the thing is that too is a function of the rise of empire and the rise of the corporate state. As long as the wealthy don't have to look at them, and as long as the what's left of the frayed and tattered middle class don't have to be threatened by them, they don't exist. even though Detroit is fast returning to its natural state, almost like a city in the Central American jungle. Even though the same is happening in other cities, even though we have built so many McMansions on our farmland that we have lost the ability to fully feed ourselves. There's no doubt that what you say is true, but there is a far cry between that kind of localized sort of barbarity and a national uprising that has the potential to topple a government. That's why, you know, that's why the teabaggers with their stupid little guns and their stupid little hats and their stupid little signs are so stupid and little. They can, no individual group can ever affect wholesale change inside an imperial governmental structure. Can't be done. Empires only topple from the outside in. Fascist governments are only toppled from the outside.
I'm telling you right now, Bob, the cities are constricting, and it's going to get really, really, really ugly. You're going to have uprising in the cities. You watch.
And the poor people will be cut down in droves, okay?
And that's the point. That's the point, though, Bob. That is the point. They don't have anything to live for. More and more, when you turn on the TV, more and more when you see advertising, it's not like in the 1920s. It's not even close. And what I mean to say that is the world of advertising is completely, it is like a gun. And it's constantly mowing into their mind. And it's all of the things that they can't obtain over and over and over and over again. It's going to be constant. You can't get this. You can't get this. You can't get this. Who's going to want to live like that, Bob? That didn't happen in the 1920s. That didn't happen in the 1930s. That didn't happen in Egypt. What I'm saying, and you add to the fact that they have weapons. Oh, now we're on a whole different playing field. It's going to happen in the cities, Bob. You see. You watch. It's going to happen.
Oh, that Mad Max stuff? No, I don't have any problem agreeing with you. But it is not going to be national in scope. It will be isolated pockets.
I said it will be dystopian. I said right from the beginning, Bob. See? Listen, I said the cities, not the rural areas. I said the cities. L.A., New York. I mean, Jesus, why do you think Kevin left? My friend moved to Seattle. You know why he left? Because it's getting crazy out there, Bob. Those cities, those guns, weapons, you add everything. The constant inundation of materialism, stuff you can't obtain. You don't want to be there, trust me.
And of course, if the corporate elite and our moneyed betters, as long as they're not touched, it doesn't matter what poor people slaughter other poor people. It doesn't matter. It wipes out a little bit more of the problem for them, because that's less people to provide services to. And the ultimate goal, remember, is to have a government that is focused solely on serving the well-being of the moneyed class. There's the revolution. If you want a revolution, there it is. And you know, here's another little hint: you're in the middle of it, David. It's not something that's coming in the future. That's the whole point of the transition from a republican form of self-government to empire.
Oh, I understand that, but I mean, let's get it straight though. That both political parties have taken us on this road, and the constant token of just passing it off to the Republicans is what I see a lot happening right now. And you keep saying, well, we don't have Marcus Aurelius. You were making a comparison of having Marcus Aurelius or Caligula. We don't have Obama's not Marcus Aurelius. And you know that, Bob. You know that. You know that. And a lot of people else, they know that too. And when you, here's the other thing. When you tell people and you say, well, you gotta go for this person. You gotta hit the Democratic ticket, hit the Democratic ticket. People out of spite are gonna hit the Republican ticket.
Well, then they're fools. And they get what they deserve. You know, there's a story out there today, about, the Michelle batshit crazy Bachman's plan, to cut the deficit. One of the things that she wants to do, is cut $400 billion in federal spending, including freezing the Veterans Affairs Department's healthcare spending and as well cuts to veterans' disability benefits. It would slice $4.5 billion from the VA and reduce 150,000 veterans' disability compensation and the amount they receive in Social Security disability income. Okay? And you want to look, like I said, you know, then they're idiots for doing that if they vote out of some sort of knee-jerk reaction. You know what? I want to look at teabaggers everywhere and say, you dumb bastards, this is what you want. This is what you said you want. This is what you voted for. Own up to it, stand by it, call for it to be done, or shut the hell up. They want it. Those opposition for opposition's sake types. Barack Obama as Marcus Aurelius? No. But Barack Obama as not Caligula? Yes. You know, I get these emails from time to time that call him a psychopath. And people way to the far left of me who say that, you know, he should be impeached and yada 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 and he's a war criminal. You know what? Maybe he is. Maybe he is. But if that is the case, then so too is everyone who takes that oath of office. And I don't have a problem saying that. From Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, everybody. Because sooner or later you do something nasty that compromises basic common human values because you wanted that job so badly. So, no, not Marcus Aurelius. Although Marcus Aurelius had a dark side. You know, he ordered a bunch of people killed. Hadrian ordered a bunch of people killed. But, you know, they go down in history as the enlightened emperors. And after them, the lights go out in empire, and it's just that slow, steady, inexorable march toward the mediocrity in which every good thing about human civilization just disappeared, and the lights went out in the West as it was overtaken by Mother Church and hate and fear and superstition and people burned alive for suggesting that sick people be periodically bathed. Until the Enlightenment, until the Renaissance, and that's a long time for the lights to go out, David.
I understand, but I'm telling you, Bob, the whole thing with the Democrats, and I'm going to tell you this right now: everyone who keeps voting for a Democrat, you're going to keep getting less and less and less, and it's going to be just like the Republicans. You know why? Because that is the setup now, people. That is the setup of monopolies. And here's the other thing. How are you going to counter that? How are you going to counter that? With a mass of people? Oh, and you're going to say, and you're going to stand there in nonviolent protest and say, oh, we're not going to do anything. We're just going to go home. We're real mad. You think that's going to work? That's not going to work, Bob, and you know it.
Then what does?
Nothing works.
Voting for the Greens?
No, Bob, no.
Teabaggers?
No, Bob. What I'm saying is that's the illusion. That's the illusion, getting mad at people, how they got mad at Nader, how they get mad at the Greens, how they get mad at any other party that steps up. It's a person's choice. It's a person's right. And what I'm saying is the Democrats, they don't own a hold of that. They don't own a brand to that. And the more and more they try to push it, the more and more you're obviously going to see the transparency.
Well, you know, over at Truth Dig, Chris Hedges has another one of those articles out that I read today. And let me see if I can find the exact language, because he's got this he's madder at liberals than he is at right wingers.
Yeah, he's obsessed about that a bit.
Hang on just a sec. This particular article talks about the predilection of liberals to go to meetings and organizing forums and yada 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 and set up email lists and, you know, do lots of things that make that are a convenient replacement for actually doing anything that matters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's truth in what he says, but I guess you know, I don't want anybody to get in just say, well, screw it, I'm done.
Yeah, I understand.
But But recognize where you are. Look around at the world you're in. Try to make things better for as many people around you as you can. And understand that you're in the fun house, and the only thing you can do is bang into the mirrors until you find the way out. And understand you may not find, it may not be you that finds the way out. It may be your grandkids. But, you know, Hedges concludes his article. He says, either we begin to militantly stand against the coal, oil, and natural gas industry, or we do not. Either we defy preemptive war and occupation, or we do not. Either we demand that the criminal class on Wall Street be held accountable for the theft of billions of dollars from small shareholders whose savings for retirement or college were wiped out, or we do not. Either we defend basic civil liberties, including habeas corpus and the prosecution of torturers, or we do not. Either we turn on liberal institutions, including the Democratic Party, which collaborate with these corporations, or we do not. Either we accept that the age of political compromise is dead, that the corporate systems of power are instruments of death that can be fought only by physical acts of resistance, or we do not. If the liberal class remains gullible and weak, if it continues to speak to itself and others in meaningless platitudes, it will remain as responsible for our enslavement as those it pompously denounces. Well, you know what? I've done some of that. I got off my ass. I was there at Appalachia Rising. That was as organic a moment as there possibly can be. It was people driven, grassroots driven. There was no astroturf to it. And there was no coverage of it.
Mm.
If you want to reform anything, and this is the closest I can come to any kind of a remedy within the structures as we have defined and described them, David. If you want to reform anything, reform the way people receive their information first and foremost. Because I guarantee you, the conversation that you and I are having, and I will have with other people on this program tonight, and on various and sundry other nights, ain't happening many other places. It's happening in some, but not damned many.
I agree with that. And before I let you go, I'm just going to say this: the left is constantly, and liberals are constantly, dogging other liberals for saying, well, if you don't vote Democrat, that's not going to happen, people. What's going to happen is it's going to be the masses who decide the elections. And you need to get over that real damn quick. It's going to be the masses who don't pay attention to politics.
Well, look, I mean, come 2012, what are you going to do?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I know who I'm going to be voting for. I'm not going to be saying, but I know who I'm going to be voting for. But guess what? My vote is irrelevant. It's in the fucking wind, Bob. And you know that. You know that because it's going to be the masses, the apathetic masses, who decide this election, the next election, and, oh, by the way, the apathetic masses that are about to vote again, they're raising their children like that.
Sure. Sure. It's the Kardashian generation.
But my point is, Bob, it's a Democratic canard. It's a Democratic canard to say that the liberals are leaving in droves. It's the apathetic masses who are taking this country apart. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, you know, I don't think we have anything to disagree on. Ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance is toxic. Ignorance is terminal. And the fact of the matter is, you're right. The people will decide. People will decide who they will vote for in 2012. How does he feel about the fetuses? You know, because that's what they'll hear for a solid year out of the pulpits of their filthy little churches. Okay? How does he feel? He don't support the fetuses and he don't love Jeebus.
But you see, that's the excuses they're already lining up on the Democrat and progressive side. They're already saying that the liberals are going to let him down. And we need to fight back on that, because it's untrue.
Well, I'm a liberal, and I'm not trying to let anybody down. I know what's going to happen in 2012. I know that the right wing is going to nominate some goddamn Caligula. Okay?
and I'm going to have a choice between their Caligula and what we've already got. And Obama is far too cozy and comfy with the Wall Streeters, maybe because he wants to be one. Okay? Or maybe he just wants to, you know, this is all, in talking with Andy last night, one of the things I didn't say but was thinking about was the fact that, you know, this is all out of Joseph Heller's Catch-22. This is that scene toward the end of the book where Colonel Cathcart and General Dreidel call Yossarian into the office and they say, listen, you don't want to fly any more missions? We're not going to make you fly any more missions. All you have to do is like us. Just say nice things about us.
Right.
Just talk about what great guys we are, and we'll be chums, and we'll be friends, and you won't fly any more missions, and you'll go home alive. And for a little bit, to Yossarian, it seems like a damn fine deal. But by the end of the book, he's figured it all out, and he's in a little rubber raft rowing like hell away from Pianosa and hoping that the current will carry him to Sweden. That there's another way not to fly any more missions, with the idea of flying missions being another way not to be used by the system. You know, everybody says, wow, Catch-22, it's the great black comic novel, along with Slaughterhouse-5, of the Second World War. And the people who say that kind of stuff, it's like, did you even read it? The vehicle for the social commentary, yes, is warfare, but it speaks to all kinds of subtext. And any time a person or a class or a nation are asked to compromise themselves in exchange, you know, just say you like us and we won't make you do any more awful shit. That's it. You know, that might be Barack Obama in a nutshell. You know, all you gotta do is say you like us, and you know what? You can have the lobster lunches too. You're not gonna be here for more than 8 years, Barack. You don't want to just sink back into obscurity, and you damn sure don't want to be running around building houses for poor people like Jimmy Carter. You want to be one of us. You want a nice house in a cul-de-sac somewhere in a civilized blue state where people won't be hollering about your birth certificate, don't you, Barack? All you got to do is like us. Now, who among us wouldn't say, you know what? That sounds like a pretty good deal. Because what Yossarian did was pretty extraordinary, to walk away from that deal and try to find another way not to participate in the underhanded dealings of the system. Am I just crazy?
No. But I did want to end this on a historic note, since you were mentioning Caligula. Did you see the news about Caligula?
Which?
They found his tomb in Rome.
Oh, yeah, I did see that. Yeah, it's outside Rome. It's on the Alban Mount, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a young guy.
Hmm.
Got sick. He was welcomed and seemed to be fairly enlightened as an emperor goes. Then he got sick, had a terrible fever, and when he got over it, he was crazier than a sprayed roach. Yeah, but that is fascinating.
Though.
Oh, yeah.
We love them.
Sure.
We just had
a reincarnated Caligula for 8 years in the White House, and yet people are running around saying that this guy is as bad as that guy, and it's just not true.
And it makes you wonder if our curiosity is going to summon these types of villains again to our country.
Well, just wait. I still think that Jebby Bush is lurking in the weeds.
I'll have to see on that one. I'm not calling that one.
I know. David, good call. I appreciate it. You have a great weekend. Bye now. Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. And understand, you know, when I say that Barack Obama's not Caligula, I'm not telling you that he shits ice cream. I'm telling you that there is a marked difference between the two.
that they're all the same, they're both the same meme, that thing has been worked and worked and worked and worked on in the halls of K Street. Because disaffecting the electorate is a Republican specialty. And a disaffected, liberal, progressive, democratic base inures to the benefit of the autocratic, theocratic, oligarchic, corporatistic right wing every time. Every time. Clayton reminding me of that one line, I can hire half the working class to kill off the other half of the working class. Randall in PA says, the burning cities will overflow into the near suburbs, a la France, and then what? Indeed. You know, there's not a city in this nation that is prepared to feed itself for more than a couple of weeks. There are very few people in this country who understand, and I'm not getting all go buy your seeds, Glenn Beck on you. But there are very few people in this country who think about the fragility of the entire structure itself. Perhaps because to think about it would be just a little bit too frightening. David in South Carolina notes, he says, millions ignored, handful of tea crackers get 24/7, 365 coverage. Millions of Iraq war protesters ignored, but 20 tea crackers toting posters with misspelled slogans and sidearms get 24/7, 365 media hype and are still getting it. They even got free air to rebut the State of the Union address. Yes! This ain't rocket science. And you don't have to call the Psychic Friends Network. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Yeah, so Obama said we have to have restraint on both sides of the protest.
Yeah, there's some I noticed the false equivalence.
I'm like, how's both sides? One side is what? Abject poverty, you know, desperate people, and the other side is military dictatorship supported by us. I mean, is he crazy? Also, this whole sort of them people in the street, they don't need no goddamn tweet and Facebook. I'm so twisted on the, you know, people freaking out about no internet. It's like, hello, most of them people in the street don't even have access to internet. It's just, I'm telling you, people here need to, like, step back away from the clicking, because that ain't what's going on over there. What's going on over there is a decade of neoliberal economic policies being rammed down the throats of most of them people.
There you go.
When NASA and Sadat, they were embracing more socialist-type economic policies, you didn't have people running amok in the streets. The combination of dictatorship and neoliberalism sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce is what is driving these people out in the street.
Well, consider when Mubarak took power, 1981. That means that his first friend in America was Ronnie Reagan, and his next friend in America was George H.W. Bush.
Well, most of the...
And they're going to, you know, those guys don't mess around. They're going to tell you what time it is.
Well, yeah, but it's just, I mean, it's incredible because, I mean, you talked about the early history of Egypt, but the history after before and right after the 1952 revolution in there, when NASA took power, I mean, it's basically a Praetorian system in Egypt right now. So look for some general or somebody else like that to pop up. Because I'm sure
you don't think El Baradei can pull it off.
You know, it's possible. And one thing about Egypt, unlike Tunisia, is and other horrible places like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, there is a semblance of civil society in Egypt. You know, but the economic stuff is really bad news there. I mean, I think the per capita is you know, 1400. I mean, it's not, you know, it's a middle income. It's a middle income country. But unfortunately, you have really, really rich people and just very poor people. And those are the people who are like, with the food, rising food prices, I mean, enough already, you know. A lot of that is what's going on. And also 30 years of this man who's out of touch, he's old. You saw his ass. It's like, dude, is that, I didn't even know if that was real.
Yeah, real. And again, maybe it's just because I'm jaded. I was not willing to take it as read that was live.
Well, and there's that, and also the whole idea, you know, the whole idea of, you don't even need to bring up the idea of democratic anything. I'm sorry. You don't get, you know, the democracy business is some American fantasy that's sort of put upon us by, you know, the bad corporate media here, because that is not what's going to be coming to the Middle East. I mean, I shudder at what is coming. There was a huge protest in Jordan, too, today, based on rising necessity prices. You see what I'm saying? The
yeah.
food prices, the heating prices, everything is just is out of control. This is when people start hitting it. That's the poverty. And you know what? God bless the Egyptian women, because all the babies were somewhere else. Did you notice?
Yep.
Then I was grateful to see that.
Well, that's the ancient history angle that I'm working. They know how to do this. I mean, this is hardwired into their genetics.
Mm. Well, it's just sort of, you know, I mean, that's why I was like, I looked at this, I had a thing on like you. I figured you was. I know I had that shit on earlier. I thought, good Jesus, you know, the Al Jazeera coverage. And, yeah, it's just, you know, I really don't see that shit going on here. I don't know where. And how it would manifest itself in this.
Well, I don't think that highly of the American people, Sandra.
Well,
I have more respect for the Egyptian people right now than the American people.
Yeah, and I also think that the level of repression that is and will come down here, people don't even know, can't even imagine it, with what's left of the middle classes. And, you know, with that in mind, and I realize it's a different story, but listen. I don't know if you listened to Malloy, because I had that story of that black woman who went to jail because she...
Yes.
That story is so outrageous, because check it out. My mother did that shit, Bob, okay? And every other black person I know, if you had any damn sense and had a way, you was using some address, doing some bullshit to get your kids, because I went to Whitey school up the road. And so when I heard that story, I was like, you got to be out of your goddamn mind. Now they just saying, they closing off all avenues, Bob.
Yes.
And that judge is going to make an example of this woman because of what? I mean, listen, that story right there.
I didn't know that we had codified first degree uppity yet.
Listen, and the thing is, they were just exercising their constituency's desires, which is in white people who don't want, because nobody was following me and my mother when she was, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
That whole thing. I was just sort of like, I just don't even realize, you know, how common that sort of practice is.
Oh, but there are these little moments everywhere. There's this comment by new Ohio Governor John Kasich.
Oh, he should be, you know what? Glenn Beck, his ass. Sorry.
Yeah, I know. The Ohio Legislative Black Caucus had a press conference yesterday to talk about.
Oh, him hired because he ain't got nobody of color?
Well, basically.
Yeah.
And at one point, it was described and explained. And this is the quote from the press conference. And then to have the pure, unadulterated gall to say that he can't find anyone.
Yeah, oh yeah.
In that same caucus meeting, when I said to the governor, if you need help, we can help you. And he said, and I quote, this is all, I mean, I got the audio, but I'm not going to fool with it. I said to the governor, if you need help, we can help you. And he said, and I quote, I don't need your people.
Yeah, no. It was just like the hood and cross people, you know what I'm saying, just out in front.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Right. That's the, you know, the
it's all good. It's all back on, you know.
Pennsylvania is going to experiment with segregation for the good of the Negroes.
Right, where they're putting black folks together 6 minutes a day. You know what I mean? I read that article. I thought, are you fucking kidding me? And then South Carolina, they're destroying what integration they got because they want to bring back people going to their own school. And if you isolate all the poor people, you can put proper attention on them. I'm telling you, this is what's going on. And now at the same time, you have Obama wanting to, you know, basically privatize education. The blacker and browner public education gets, now it needs to be privatized. You understand how sick that all is?
Yeah, but to be fair, in places like where I live here, there's not. There's no minority population to speak of up at the high school my kids go to, and you know they're in the same they're being squeezed out of their school too because we're going to consolidate.
It's across the board, but I just mean the sort of pre-Brown view board is just doing my head in and locking up mothers who just want their kids to get a better education. Is that where we're at now, Bob?
It's not only where we're at, but where we're going. These are all just little toe dabblings in the water, to see if we can stick the whole body politic in yet.
Oh yeah, no, but this story here it just ripples with implication because the whole idea is that wait a minute, now if you sent your kid to another school, wouldn't it wash out? You know, from one school district to another, obviously. The difference in cost is so great. I mean, just there's so many issues around this. It's like, oh, wait a minute. You're going to make this disabled man pay $30,000.
Yeah.
What? You know.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, you know, some of this stuff I guess I'm kind of used to because I grew up amongst it. Where I grew up in Alabama, Sandra, you had two... There it is again, separate but equal school systems in every county. You had, for instance, the county seat where I grew up had a city school system, and I went to school in the city school system. It was fully funded. We had all kinds of wonderful stuff, nice new schools. And then there was the county school system where people outside the city limits went, and those schools sucked, and they suck to this day. Because the system is still in place. And people who could afford it, who lived outside city limits, if they could afford it, they paid tuition to send their children to the public schools inside the city system.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a word for all this. Apartheid.
Yes.
You know?
And it has racial overtones, but it damn sure has economic overtones.
Oh, yeah, no, it's absurd. I mean, that's what my best friend was saying. You know, it's a hideous story. But once again, they can never go down with the class analysis because the black face is right there. And I have to agree with her because, you know, they will completely skip over that in this story because the racial dynamic is so, I guess we're so used to analyzing things from that point of view. But just in general, now them poor girls are out of a better situation and this woman's whole livelihood is at risk now because of a felony.
There you go.
I'm just like, oh my god, I'm still so disturbed by that story. I'm just like, wow, you know.
But again, not to just sort of gratuitously beat on what appears to be the theme of the evening, that's how empires behave.
Well, oh yeah, no, but you know, I must commend you on the security state, you know, Caligula versus some other technocrat who could just sort of make it function, because that's definitely what Obama falls under. And Bush was some sort of Caligula, because you get, as we saw so blatantly with the retention of Gates, you know, that was just a sort of a slip-up on their part, but there it was, glaring for all of us to see if you could look.
Yeah, if you would bother to.
Yeah, and he just slipped right in there, a dark face, softer tones, but the empire continued on. So you're right. When 2012 comes and the monster from the horizon is coming down, you're going to be like, good Lord, and go vote for Obama.
Yeah, he's going to look better. And well, it's like that little gag that I trot out every so often about, you know, the little ABC News special report that plays in my head every time I get mad at Barack Obama. You know, we take you to the White House now for the swearing in of President Palin.
Well,
and you get all better in a real hurry.
But see, I think that the U.S. is at risk of making just a huge mistake. I mean, whereas in Rome, you know, they did have enough sense to support the populace on some levels. In this country, the corporate state is so pernicious, it has the risk of cannibalizing itself. You see, and I think that's where this country could falter in its,
But even that went by the wayside, Sandra, because, you know, even during the Roman Republic, they had the grain dole. There was a fixed price for wheat that was provided to the poor at a certain amount per month.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like they had the spectacle. I mean, but I'm saying that the corporate state here, though, is not even that astute. It's just sort of scorched earth at this point.
Right. You know, when you've got these idiot tea crackers out there screaming about the whale fire, and they don't even understand that the whale fare is not designed to support poor people, but is designed to buy surplus production from corporate agribusiness. Well, yeah, the cannibalization image begins to rear its ugly head, because if the tea baggers are bitching about that, then sooner they're biting the hand that's literally feeding them right now.
And don't tell me that this sort of spike in worldwide commodity prices and the sort of infestation of Monsanto's in Washington, that shit is connected too.
Oh, I got me some Monsanto in the stack tonight, Sandra.
Well, I'm looking at, and once again, I look at Obama, and, you know, it's also soothing, but he is stacking the deck as far as his corporate affiliation. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know. And I think that there is also an argument to be made that this sort of hiccup that's going on around the world with these in the Arab region is also a function of a declining hegemon. I hate to keep coming back to that theme, but, you know, the U.S. ain't handling their business very well. Shit's unraveling.
Well, we lack the ability to do it. And it's not, you know, it's not because Barack Obama's a fascist, Islamist, Kenyan Muslim.
No, I'm just saying, I just think that, you know, there's so many different angles to look at, you know, what's going on in the Middle East. And trust me, business, they don't want none of this. They want the dictators. Trust me. This is not...
Sure they do, because, you know, they make the trains run on time and they create stability. But you've also got to take into account, I think, Sandra, that there was a profound loss of face that, frankly, to give him credit, give the devil his due, George H.W. Bush saw out there and caused him to make certain decisions the way he did. We lost a lot of face in Iraq and Afghanistan. The entire Arab world that had sort of looked at itself going, don't do that. The United States might get mad and drop the hammer on us. Well, look at it. We dropped the hammer on Iraq, and it turned out to be worse for us than it was for Iraq. And we've bankrupted, bankrupted ourselves on it. And look what's going on in Afghanistan. And now the Arab world's looking around going, that's what we were afraid of?
Yeah, no. When people told and predicted what could possibly happen with George Bush's little activities, and it's just coming to pass. But, you know, I almost choked when Obama was talking about when he was in Cairo, and I was like, ew, you sure you want to talk about that? You know what I mean? I just was like, dude, ugh, I don't know. It just bothered me so much. Yeah, and he was in Cairo making his little "We Like You Too" Muslim speech.
Singing the Barney song to the Muslim world. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was only 2 years ago, and I just didn't see it as being. I thought it was a bit kind of bizarre that he would bring that up in the lieu of in face of what's going on now. But anyway, I mean, you know, I mean, it's not really. I'm not saying it's on Obama. I just am like looking at the the optics, and it's not very good.
And of course, you know, Mubarak's answer is to sack all the ministers.
Well, that's hilarious, and you called it right, because that's just what goes on in that mentality. It's like, dude, you know what? But I'm not too sure. I guess it's a matter of momentum with the protesters. I do think that his time is up, though.
But he identified, I do too, but he identified the linchpin in the process, and that's the Egyptian middle class, because they've got one. And if they come out in the streets and join the poor and the dispossessed, then he knows it's over and it really is time to get on the jet for Geneva.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what I mean. I do think that, you know, who's the guy you just mentioned before?
Al-Baradei?
Yeah, you know, that is something to sort of focus on, you know, how they treat him, although he's a bit old, you know, for the generation that's acting out of control there, but we'll see.
Well, and the thing is, you'd like to say something like Nelson Mandela wasn't exactly a spring chicken when he got out of prison, but there's a whole lot more moral force behind a Nelson Mandela than there is a Mohammed Al-Baradei.
Well, yeah, 27 years in prison. Yeah, that's.
And the thing is, we don't know who is in the Egyptian prisons.
Oh no, and also I'm just sort of shuddering because. Listen, he's been in power for 30 years. You don't stay in power for nothing unless you're some sort of horror show. So I shudder at what brutalities are going on right now in Egypt, you know? And it's very brave of the Egyptian people to be doing this. And I think that should be acknowledged, you know?
And that's what's a little bit disturbing about the both sides should use yada, 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 the false equivalents. On one side, you've got tanks, helicopters, guns, gas, water cannons, bullets. On the other side, you've got signs, rocks, and handkerchiefs wrapped around faces to ward off the tear gas. It's kind of hard to call for any level of equivalent conduct between those two.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. It's just sort of like listening to that drivel. You're like, oh, please. You know, especially when I was just looking at some of the economic numbers for Egypt, I was just like, wow, 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 and wow. Especially now, the tourism, that's going to go down the drain, and that's some huge percentage, you know?
It's the heart and soul of much of the Egyptian economy.
And Israel's another thing. I'm like nervous as hell on that ticket because them people crazy. Bombs on Lebanon, maybe we'll take out Iran. I mean, who knows? You know? So there's a, you know... Because I heard some Israeli officials saying, well, you know, he doesn't think that the Arabs can afford democratic exercises at the moment. Can you believe that?
It's sickening.
Anyway.
It is. It's truly sickening. There's you know, I tweeted earlier, you may have seen, you know, Mubarak doesn't understand the first law of holes, that when you're in one, you stop digging. And on the other hand, Israel needs to remain silent.
But and their guns need to remain silent too. I just am sort of, you know.
I mean, you reckon anything? I mean, you can't convince me that Israel isn't ready to send the Hermann Göring division or whatever the hell they've got right into Sinai at the first sign of problems.
Well, that's the thing. There's that, but see, Israel also should be concerned about this. This ain't helping their cause either. So
no, because this is the. The peace treaty with Egypt is what makes everybody else look twice at the idea of hostilities with Israel.
That's what I'm saying. So, you know, the thing is, though, because Israel always acts like they're caged animals, it's just scary, that's all. And all the weaponry they have, it's just kind of like, oh, please, 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 you know?
Yeah, and you can only hope that there have been a few cables that have gone out from the State Department telling Israel, you know, stay out of this. Stay out of this.
Yeah, hopefully. Oh, my. But who knows? Anyway, that's about it. There's something else I wanted to ask you, but I just really can't.
Well, I've got an email to forward you from Andy. He actually wrote a little bit on the GSE question that you sent in last night.
Oh, right. Yes. No, I, you know, because what I read actually was that there's some sort of restructuring in the works that the Obama administration has, quote, delayed. And anytime it's delayed, it probably means it's not friendly enough to the banks.
Yeah.
So, and I'm just wondering, you know, and because the thing about the Fannie Mae, you know, that was sort of made public because Johnson couldn't afford the cost of the war. I mean, all it came out of that period.
Right.
So anyway, yeah. So yeah, no, forward that. You know, that's fine.
Yeah, it's on the way now.
Okay, listen, so have a good weekend.
All right, take care, Sandra. Bye now.
Bye.
Lots of lines open, by the way, as we've sort of marched through them through the first 2 hours of the program here. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. And, hey, seriously, are there four of you out there? Are there four people who can send in $10? Because then I get to shut up about this. Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. We need $40, and we've made the fundraising goal for the month of January, and we begin January on an even keel. Onward we go. Oh, no, we don't. Okay. It is about 7 minutes past 8 o'clock, and we'll see who's ringing in here. And you can fire it up if you want in on this conversation as well. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
Hey, Jim. What's up?
Well, I've just been listening to your program But nonetheless, I was just thinking about the situation in Egypt. You know, Egypt has sort of been our linchpin of peace in the Middle East, regardless of the type of regime that exists there.
Right, and that's why we were able to prop up somebody as brutal as Mubarak.
Well, I don't know how brutal he is. I know nothing about his prison.
He's brutal.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know. I'll have to see a definitive definition of a comparison between him and, for example, Saddam. Is Saddam? I don't think so.
No. Mubarak doesn't write the cheesy romance novels in Arabic.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the way he governs his people. But nonetheless, do you think for one split second that the middle classes of Egypt who are fairly comfortable under Mubarak are going to take sides with those people who are out throwing pots and pans in the streets?
They may very well, because they're being pinched by the economic processes that are at work there as well as the poor are. They may not feel the pinch as badly, but they darn sure feel it, and they've been feeling it more and more and more over the last few months.
Well, I think that's been happening all over the world, don't you?
Some places worse than others.
Well, I think it's been happening in a lot of places.
And, you know, remember, Egypt can't feed itself. And so what happens around the world gets magnified in countries that can't. That's why you wind up with food riots and things like that in nations that can't feed themselves.
Well, let me ask you this. Who controls the food distribution in Egypt?
In what regard? It's controlled. It's controlled by the government in one regard,
okay.
but it's also controlled by the multinational corporations in the sense of how much the government itself has to pay.
Okay, but these multinational corporations and governmental mechanisms are the ones that control food distribution and food allocation and things of that nature. Correct?
To a certain extent.
Well, I think to an entire extent. What you said, if Egypt can't feed itself. I mean, are they totally indigent?
They grow. I mean, they have a farming industry, but they have 80 million people. So
well, I know that the ability of the Egyptians to, for example, the flooding of the Nile and things of that nature was seriously attenuated by the construction of the Aswan High Dam.
Correct.
And there were, but of course, that in turn was supposed to produce lots of fertilizers and things of that nature, which would offset the necessity for the Nile to flood the way it did in pharaonic times.
And up until the very construction of the Aswan Dam itself.
Well, that was in 1964.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's when, of course, Egypt, nonetheless, the reason Nasser was cooperated with the Soviets to do that was to increase Egypt's ability to feed itself and not to depend upon the flooding of the Nile every season.
Right, because, you know, from time immemorial, the early Egyptians developed something called a Nilometer, so that, you know, down around the first cataract, so that they could see what the inundation would be by the time it reached their grain fields. And there were the cubits of plenty, the cubits of death.
Nile of the White Nile, and it all begins in the uplands of Ethiopia, where it comes down from. And, of course, they depending on its flooding, and whether there would be years of plenty or years of plenty. But nonetheless, the Aswan High Dam was supposed to put a damper on that and to guarantee further security.
And to generate electricity as well, yeah, because it's hydro.
Exactly.
And it was supposed to be a bold step for Egypt into the 20th century.
Well, certainly it was. The only things that suffered were the monuments at places like Abu Simbel and things like that. And, of course, UNESCO got involved in that, and they raised, those, for example, the temple of Ramesses 300 meters above Lake Nasser.
Yes.
So that was...
But it still, it turns out archaeologists are finding out they still managed to flood a lot of important crap that they didn't know was there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're still finding stuff there. But, you know, like I said in my email to you, autocracies certainly have benefits and things of that nature, and they have benefited. And unfortunately, and this is my position, and it may be completely and probably is in contravention to your own, when I look at the history of certain autocracies and their role upon the stage of history, I mean, going back to Roman times, I want to clarify something with you. I mean, who was Caligula's father? Was it not Germanicus?
Yes, he was Germanicus's son.
Okay.
And Germanicus was bumped off.
And, of course, Caligula was, of course, one of the people who lived with Tiberius on the island of Capri, correct?
Yeah, yes. Some say that it was Tiberius who ordered the assassination of Germanicus.
Well, yeah. Tiberius did lots of strange things.
Because Germanicus was beloved of the people,
and Caligula was called Little Boots because of he was the boots. He had little boots, and he was very popular with the Roman legions in the north, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, boots. Roman military boots in Latin is caligae.
Exactly, and the son of Marcus Aurelius was Commodus.
Yes,
who was kind of slightly nuts and caused lots of problems, particularly with the eastern portion of the empire.
Very true.
With the Parthians.
Everybody had trouble with the Parthians, but yes.
Well, the Parthians, you know what they call the Parthian shot. They were people you didn't mess with. But if you go back to other autocracies, for example, in France, right, they had their revolution there. And it was a revolution that really got out of hand.
And wound up taking them back to where they, you know, you wind up with Napoleon. Yes.
But let's not go there quite quickly. But, I mean, you had Danton, Robespierre, the Jacobins, and the Girondists. And then, of course, you went through the fall of Robespierre and the Directory. The Directoire, and then, of course, Napoleon came in top of that, and he was pretty much a hard fellow to deal with as well. And, you know, revolutions devour their own children. And if you look at Russia, for example, I want to ask you one question. If you were a citizen of the world at that time, I think I would have much preferred to have lived under the Tsars than I would have Joseph Stalin and what he did.
Depends on what kind of citizen you were.
Well, depending on anybody, because at least under the Tsars, they were a lot more forgiving and a lot more humane, in spite of their excesses, than the Stalinists were in the 1930s, or starting in 1929 when Stalin took power.
Oh, without a doubt, Stalin turned murder into a full-on industry.
And the Tsars, of course, were, you know, in spite of their excesses, were much more humane by comparison.
Well, ask a victim of a pogrom.
Well, ask a victim of the purges. So what's the difference?
Right, and both were autocrats.
dead's dead. Now, they had the Pale of Settlement and things of that nature, and the Cossacks used to ride through, but not nearly with the regularity of how the Red Armies would surround the Kulaks and take everything they had and kill all their horses and kill everything they possibly could. And the 4 million that died in the Civil War that followed the Revolution. You know, even as bad as Nicholas II was, he did have one minister who was very, very good, and that was Stolypin. And under him, if the war had not intervened, Russia could have developed into a humane, liberal, democratic, constitutional monarchy. But the war intervened and stopped it. And, of course, Nicholas was not a very good emperor. But nonetheless, the war is what took him out. And even going back to his great-great-grandfather or great-grandfather, Alexander II, he freed the serfs before we even thought about freeing the slaves. Now, the freedom of the serfs was a cumbersome system, which Stolypin was trying to make better. So, you know, these Bolsheviks and people like that and social revolutionaries and Black Hand, well, what did they do to the very Tsar Liberator, Alexander II? They threw a bomb underneath his carriage.
Yes. That's very true.
On the site of his assassination, his Church of the Blood. Been there. As a matter of fact, when the first bomb was thrown, he was unhurt, and he got out to see about his people who were hurt, and that's when another bastard threw another bomb and killed him. They always try to kill the ones who try to make it better.
Sure. Look at the murder of Lord Mountbatten by the IRA. Do you recall that in the 1970s?
I remember he was blown up when he was out fishing in his little fishing boat and things of that nature. And the Irish question is one that's it's pretty insoluble, but going too far. But I don't compare Lord Mountbatten to Alexander II.
No, that's not the comparison that I was making. But move on, or we'll move on. The problem, as I understand it, though. Is that I don't know. Are you making the argument, Jim, that there are simply some people who are not suited to democracy?
Absolutely.
And what is it, if we can put our fingers on it, what is it that makes one suited or not suited? I mean, I can understand. I'm not criticizing the position. I think it's one that deserves actually more considered discussion than we can have even here on this program. In the course of learning about world religions, for instance, I couldn't help coming to the question of whether or not democracy, as we understand it, and I don't think anybody really understands. There's not a lot of people who understand democracy when they say the word. But a religion whose holy writings predicate a hereditary caliphate. Doesn't that sort of suggest that democracy is not inside the, you know, is not within the scope of consideration there?
Are you referring to Islam?
Yes.
Well, I don't think they were fairly democratic either, were they?
That's what I'm saying. The hereditary caliphate is built into the religious system. You know, the you know, this is not any sort of anti-Islamic comment on my part, because I'm not. But I have read enough of the books to understand that the caliphate is sort of built in. And with the really ultra-weird radical types within Islam, they yearn for a worldwide caliphate in which one caliph will rule the world in the name of Islam.
Yeah, that's right.
There are sects of truly bizarre pre-Vatican II Roman Catholics who still dream of a day when the Pope will rule the world from Rome.
Well, I think they've pretty much given that up.
Oh, no, there are some who haven't.
Well, the Opus Dei and people like that. But going back to the Arabian situation, as an offshoot remark, some of the most beautiful tales in the world are the tales of the Arabian Nights, translated by Burton and Speke.
Well, sure, and the poetry of Rumi is some of the most amazing poetry ever crafted on the planet.
And the culture that was achieved under these caliphates was incredibly advanced compared to Western Europe when they were just living in hovels and huts and drafty castles and had knowledges of algebra and medicine and things of that nature. So there's, like I say, and like I said in my email, there are certain types of autocracies and things that do produce good things and not all bad. And I don't believe, quite frankly, that democracy is a product for export necessarily.
And that is, you know, that is one of the eternal questions, because democracy, the concept of democracia, rises out of the Western, primarily Greek tradition. God knows the Romans wanted nothing to do with pure democracy.
Well, I don't blame them. I wouldn't have either if I had been a Roman.
And Plato hated it as well, because it killed his teacher. You know, it wasn't oligarchs that killed that passed sentence on Socrates. It was the democracy that did. And so, being a product of so-called Western thought, one wonders, you know, does it translate to other cultural traditions?
No, I don't think it does.
And if it is tried in other traditions, do we, you know, we bandy the word about here in the United States as if we practice it when we don't.
No,
you know,
we don't.
There are little pockets of democracy that reside primarily, almost only, in the state of Vermont. You know, I've thought about it from time to time. What would happen if you tried to convince people in Mississippi to have democracy on a local level like they have in Vermont? It'd never fly.
Well, it wouldn't work.
And it wouldn't fly for the same reason that the Spartans had no interest in democracy, because the Spartans had a helot class that they routinely abused and used to prop up their autocratic their autocratic state.
It was a very brutal type of system, but there are elements of certain autocracies in history that have not been quite as brutal.
Well, you know, Plato in the Republic does not, in trying to contemplate what is just government, ultimately comes down and say, you know, your only hope is to breed philosopher kings. And you have to start them out by teaching them music and poetry and art and language and hope for the best. Because the one problem with autocracies, Jim, is that it's a dice roll every time the autocrat dies.
Well, same thing happens when presidents leave office. You know, same thing happens. I mean, whether they die or whether they leave office or whatever, you know, the Enlightenment of, for example, like Catherine the Great. I mean, Catherine was a very enlightened woman. Unfortunately, she had a problem with a guy named Pugachev who was trying to overthrow her.
Well, look at, you know, we revere Elizabeth I of England.
And Catherine the Great was very much in contact with the philosophes and the encyclopedists and things of that in France, and Voltaire and Diderot, and of course was back in her time was a very enlightened woman.
And French was spoken in the Romanov court the way that Greek was spoken among the well-heeled in Rome.
And you know, when you look back, for example, I sent you those that PowerPoint slide, which I hoped you'd mentioned on your program, about St. Petersburg. How do you think Petersburg came into being?
Through the autocratic rule of Peter the Great.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, it was called the City of Bones.
Yeah.
It didn't come back through any form of love and peace and generosity. It came back, he willed it into being, and it had to be so.
And didn't care how many people had to die to build it.
Well, unfortunately, that is the way history has worked.
Well, I think it's the way humanity works. You see, I'm not one of these people who's in love with democracy, because I at least have my eyes wide open. We run around the world, Jim, as the United States, acting like we have the right to define what it is when, as I said, we don't even practice it. So if somebody else tries it and hybridizes it, we have no business telling them that they ain't doing it right. I mean, the biggest democracy on the planet is not the United States, because A, the United States is not a democracy, and two, because the biggest democracy on the planet is India. And look at the problems with it, with which India is rife.
I don't think I would prefer to live in India.
Nor I, although there is much to be said for it, and it's a beautiful place, and you'd love to visit, and I'd love to visit. Don't necessarily want to live there.
I mean, it's not all Gandhi and the Taj Mahal, that's for damn sure.
No, it's a whole lot more. It's a whole lot more a black hole of Calcutta.
Precisely. But as far as, you know, citizens of the government are concerned, I can't be any type of apologist for democracy or whatever. You hope that you can achieve some type of compendium, or that's the right word, or amalgam between the rulers that be and the people who are ruled, and hope that the ones that are on the top are humane and enlightened. And that's just the way history has been. We can't rewrite it. It's just the way it's been, and I think that's the way it's going to continue to be. And as I've said before, history is cyclical. It is not linear. But we're going to see, you know, a lot of things happen that are going to be repetitive. But I would take no great pleasure in seeing the current administration in Egypt fall, because I have a feeling what I know will come after it.
You're afraid of some sort of Islamic Republic.
Or even worse. I mean, I've seen so many of these things when these so-called social revolutionaries and people who espouse liberal doctrines come into power. Hell, they become more despotic than the ones they replace. And you know it, and I know it. And there's no argument to get.
But how old is Hosni Mubarak?
I don't know how old the man is.
80s.
Well, he's in his 80s. Someone's going to have to replace him. And I would hope that someone who is, you know, under his tutelage, who could be a little more enlightened than he, would come into Egypt and to take over the reins of government. That's what I would hope. I mean, it doesn't hurt to hope, does it?
No, and that's really, under the circumstances, all you really have. Let's see. Yeah, he was born May the 4th, 1928. So, you know, he's leaving one way or the other.
Well, unfortunately, he has no access to a fountain of youth and things of that nature. And like I say, Egypt is the linchpin of peace in the Middle East. And I would very, very hate to see that linchpin removed, because you could have all types of force multipliers in other states in that area, Jordan, Syria, and then things of that nature, you know?
So, and of course, as I've said before, I have no faith in our ability to get this right.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, you know, people try. They fail. They succeed. They try and succeed. And it's one step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. So.
And always the great darkness looms.
There you go. Well, listen, you be good, or be good at it, and we'll talk to you later.
All right. Take care, Jim. Big darkness soon come. And I mean, I hope I'm going right back to the phones. Lines are open, 877-443-2366. If you want to talk about this, I just try to live my life with my eyes open. This ain't no democracy, the United States. It's not. We bandy it around as though religious zealots would carry religious icons during festival parades through the streets. But it's not a democracy. Little town meetings in Vermont, that's democracy. We call this is a hybridized thing, and we call it representative democracy. But of the people who can hear my voice right now, how many of you actually feel like the representative who participates in democracy for you actually does it for you? You know who my congressman is. My congressman is Nick Joe Rahal. And if a coal company moved in right next to me and said, that little house that Kincaid lives in, we're going to blow it all to smithereens, Nick Joe Rahal would say, well, is there any coal under the ground? Oh, a bunch of coal. Blow him to hell! Because he said that about thousands of families all over southern West Virginia. Blow them to hell! If there's money in the ground, blow them up! Hard for me to get worked up about democracy when that's the democracy with which I have any passing experience. I understand what Jim's saying about autocracy. But, you know, for every enlightened despot, it seems within the human experience that there's a dozen the bloodthirsty sons of bitches. And what Hillary Clinton said to the Arab leadership, 3 months ago or whatever, is true. The people of these various countries are finding out that they have been ripped off. That a very, very small percentage of their countrymen have control of a vast percentage of the nation's wealth. Now, it's hard to hear somebody like Hillary Clinton say that and not recognize that she's, you know, the white woman speak with forked tongue. Because the same thing obtains here. We have re-entered an era of the robber baron. And the funny thing is that the teabaggers and the other little pig-licking fools have begged to have it done to them. Hit me again, I can put a little stank on it! But it's true. Jesus, God, you know what I'd... Okay, I'm going to get in trouble for this, because I'm nonviolent. I would love to see the merciless bastards who run Saudi Arabia run out of Saudi Arabia. I'd love to see that. Because they are some special brand of evil. And I bet you my dollar to your dime that the royal house of Ibn Saud is straining like a dog trying to shit a peach pit right now over what's going on in Egypt. And I like the idea of them doing that, just in light of what they have done to so many of their own. Because by the time revolutions get ugly, it's because the people against whom the revolutions get ugly have earned every damn bit of it. They're not getting it, they earned it. And the royal house of Ibn Saud has been compounding interest on their evil for generations now. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Jethro.
Yeah, we're going straight to hell. Yeah, there's nothing to slow us down.
In a hand car.
Yeah, well, Hank Williams the Third.
Oh, I love Hank. I love Hank the Third.
Yeah, so all this Middle Eastern stuff, it's, I don't know. Something else seems to be going on behind the scenes. But to me, these Egyptians, they're sick of the dictatorship, the regime, and it's the puppet regime, and we're controlling it, just like we controlled Sadat.
Sure. And just like we can, do we remember Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines?
Oh, yeah.
We bought a lot of shoes.
Yes. Well, but that's what we're doing. I mean, we're propping up the Saudi regime. We're propping up the Egyptians. We're propping up
the Jordanians, yeah.
Kuwait, all of those. We've got our props in there to ensure that there's not going to be any Islamic takeover or anything like that. And we're doing it, really, I don't think we're doing it that much for our own interest that much, but for the interest of Israel. And that's, to me, it's been stinky foreign policy for a long time.
That's the elephant in the room.
But something else, you know, all these countries, I'm sure they're going to try to blame Hezbollah or Syria or, you know, the Iranian devils for interfering, something like that. But
Jethro, I had an email a little bit ago, tweet Marty sent me tweets from Jeremy Scahill talking about what Radio Rwanda, otherwise known as Fox News, has been doing. Let's see, here's a quote. Groups linked to Al-Qaeda in danger of taking over the government in Cairo. and then last summer, Jeremy Scahill noted, last summer, Eric Prince of Blackwater, remember him?
Oh, yeah.
Said he continues to train security personnel from Egypt.
Hmm.
Shall we revisit that statement you just made about there are unseen forces at work?
Exactly. Yeah, that those guys were. Yeah, they're in with the CIA and stuff. They've done, you know, they're doing a lot of covert ops and. Yeah.
Well, and remember what Eric Prince is, Jethro. Eric Prince is a millennialist, fundamentalist Christian. Everything that Eric Prince does is done with two things in mind. One, to make more money. And two, to make Jeebus come back. And so if he can help destabilize that region, that just means Jesus coming a little bit sooner.
Yeah, kind of on a side note, Seymour Hersh had come out and said that, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, McChrystal, and all these, just a small 9 or 10 right-wing Christian guys who are all like in the Knights of Malta, something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they were all into this crusader thing, and they're wanting to fight another crusade. And I think McChrystal denied that he anything. You know.
Well, I mean, did you see that story out there for the last couple of weeks about this this program that the military developed that was designed to try to sort of combat PTSD on the front end? Only it turned out to be an onward Christian soldiers sort of fundamentalist evangelical indoctrination program.
Oh, kind of like the 69 Virgin version, only the Christian style.
More or less, yeah.
Yeah, you're dying for Jesus and America, apple pie, mom, and the girl back home.
Jeebus.
Yeah. So anyway, so we've got that faction going on, but. I think behind a lot, some of this Middle Eastern unrest, and I think we're going to see some of it coming up in the Central American and South American countries too.
Did you notice who Hillary Clinton interrupted her meeting with to come out and do some comments about Egypt? Who she was actually talking to? She was talking to one of those fascist skullbreakers from Colombia. That's who she was in a meeting with.
Right. Yeah, that's another puppet set up down there. And it's a covert war, too, and one we don't hear much about. But, we're doing a lot of dirty work down there, and it's not a good thing.
It wasn't lost on me that the first thing she said about Colombia was that we remain very disturbed about the 29 miners that died in the coal mine in Colombia. Well, that's another case of, you know, hellhole coal extraction. Because if you try to, every time the miners try to organize down there, people disappear them back somewhere and put a bullet behind their left ear, and the union movement, well, what union movement?
Right. Yeah, so, but I think, that seems to be, us working that area too. But I think the Chinese, maybe with the help of the Russians, I think they're moving in to some of these Middle Eastern countries that have been opposing, and they're establishing ties, I think, also with Venezuela, Chavez, and some of the other countries in South America. And I think that's behind a lot of this. And I think our ability to try to push and dictate things, I think we're going to see a diminishing of that. And, it might not be full swing in our lifetimes, but soon come. Income is true, and I just don't. I think people are waking up, and how long can we prop things up? How long can we protect, the interest of Israel? think that's behind it all. And where they say you can't put democracies in, well, everybody doesn't need a democracy. That's, as you said, you know, we don't even practice it. So how can we say that's what someone else needs to do?
Well, I understand Jim's point that it may not be suited everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, look at Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a tribal culture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's all well and good as long as it is not used, you know, in a imperial manner to say, you know, that's why the British didn't get out of India. Well, these savages, they can't run things on their own. We got to hang around till.
Right. Well, that's what, you know, that's why Rudyard Kipling coined the phrase the white man's burden. But, you know, look, again, hearkening back to ancient Rome, at no point in the history of the Roman Empire did the Senate ever cease to be. And to this day, if you walk around Rome, the public fountains all have four little letters, SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romani, the Senate and the people of Rome. The facade of the Senate was maintained all the way through empire, just as in the American Empire now, Jethro, we maintain the facade or the conceit of the Congress.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, it doesn't matter who's in Congress or anything else who gets elected now. I think things were set up for the Democrats and Republicans to have issues that are going to keep each other, you know, keep us at each other's throats, and to argue while they're just, you know, stealing us blind and seemingly, and it doesn't matter who the president is either. I mean, I had hopes for Carter, you know, after Nixon and Ford. Had high hopes for Carter. Well, you know, he didn't play the inside game.
Right, and him go away.
Yeah. Then I had high hopes for Clinton. Yeah. Didn't turn out. It turns out he's, you know, Daddy Bush's boy or something. So, and then, you know, then after W, it's like, oh boy, Obama, you know, finally, after all, you know, after all these years, and even the Kennedy myth, you think that someone is actually going to make a difference, but it's not happening.
Nope.
Somebody else is running the show with the president. No matter how much you promise, when you get in there, things change.
Well, that's what one of the things that Jimmy Carter said in the book that he recently published. He said when I got into the Oval Office, I was surprised to find out how little power the president actually has, because the thing has become in large parts self-perpetuating, Jethro, and that's the way empires are. All that you do is tinker with the machine a little bit. You never bring in a new machine. You know, you might change the plugs or the points or the spark plug wires, but you're not going to pull the engine, because the engine is controlled externally from places you as president can't reach. You know, I know nobody made, I'm reminded of this quite frequently, nobody made Barack Obama take the job, but the fact of the matter is, he knows what it means to if he crosses Wall Street. He knows what it means if he crosses the great global transnationals.
Yeah.
And he came into a situation in which we are in debt servitude to the Chinese government.
Yes, and he knows what it means to cross the CIA or yeah, the military-industrial complex. It's just a no-win situation. And I think they're going to let him, you know, maybe be a little bit different than Republicans socially and some other things like that. But as far as foreign policy and the military action, I don't see much difference. I think we're doing some covert action in Yemen and Somalia.
Not as covert as we might like for it to be in Pakistan.
Yeah,
sure.
And that's stirring a hornet's nest up there too. If we keep going in there, I think some of these Pakistanis are gonna, you know, the Pakistani army is they're actually in control, I think. So.
Right, and while we're sitting here sweating ourselves stupid over nuclear arms that don't exist in Iran, they do exist in Pakistan, Jethro, and it would not be that hard for a real nut job to get control over them.
Right.
And then, you know, there goes the neighborhood.
And I think we're trying to play Pakistan against India a little bit there. I don't know if we know what we're doing or not. China's back there in the background somewhere, too. So, I think we need to get we need to get out of there, because I think the Chinese are a little bit stronger than what we think they are. Like 3 years ago, it was an electric sub, it wasn't even a nuclear powered, it was diesel. You know, then it runs on batteries. It surfaced like almost in the middle of this carrier task force.
Yeah, that was a little embarrassing.
Yeah. But then they're saying that this missile launch off the West Coast was from a Chinese submarine, because the contrail was way too wide and dark, which meant it wasn't as advanced electronically and technologically advanced as our stuff, and they could identify it by that. So if they're doing things like that, I think they're trying to rub our nose in it.
Well, that was just, you know, if that was indeed the case, Jethro, that's just a little friendly warning.
Oh, yeah. Off the coast like that?
Yeah, don't fail to pay the VIG.
And something else that kind of backs that up, I mean, at the White House dinner or whatever, they had something. They had a piano player, a singer. That was a Chinese fellow. And he played some Chinese propaganda song. It was like a anti-American propaganda song.
I saw a right-wing pitch about that not too long back.
Right.
They were having a fit. You know, the Chinese piano player plays insidious, inscrutable music that means bad business for America.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it means bad business, but that's...
But, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I get in my email box every blessed day.
But the Chinese aren't the, you know, the American way is to, you know, John Wayne, put a bayonet in your mouth, charge a machine gun nest, right?
Right.
That's not the Chinese way. Subtle stuff like that is...
No, they wrote the book on, remember, the first part of Lao Tzu says, if you get to the fighting part, you've already failed in a big chunk of the war.
Exactly. And, you know, financially, they're whipping us on that now.
Sure. And but by the same token, they understand how fragile, and that is the key to a certain amount of global neoliberal economic policy that undergirds globalism, is to make everybody dependent on everybody else so that nobody throws a match on the sea of gasoline.
Yeah, but what they're looking for is, the World Bank and the International Monetary Federation, they're looking to kind of take us down and make China the top dog, I think. I mean, just like Chinese communist saying that they would hang the capitalist with the rope that they sold him.
Yeah.
I mean,
the Nikita Khrushchev banging with his shoe on the podium, screaming, "We will take you without firing a shot."
Right.
Well, he may not have been speaking for the... He might not have spoken so appropriately or accurately for the Russians, but he damn sure was downright prophetic about the Chinese.
And we've transferred a lot of technology over to China, mining technology, and we've got automobile assembly lines going over there. They're developing a whole massive manufacturing base, while ours is diminishing.
So. Indeed. Well, Jethro, let us finish up as we always did. What is it?
It's madness, I tell you.
It is madness, Jethro. You have a great weekend, my friend.
Planet X, New Madrid, 2012. What's it going to be?
One from column A and two from column B.
The mothership.
All right, you take care. Later, Jethro. Bye now. Jethro, I don't hear from Jethro very often, but Jethro has been with us from the very beginning. I mean, from when the lights went on February the 2nd, 2004, back in America's fifth smallest radio market. Beckley, West Virginia. Thanks, Jethro. Email comes in from Andy. He says, I'm with you in regards to the Saudis. Any friends of the Bushes are an enemy of mine. Also, any group, the Egyptian people, that take on a tyrant, a dictator, a torturer, supported by the Chamber of Commerce, has got my full, unequivocal support. God bless the people of Egypt. Let freedom reign, and the dictator be shipped off to Saudi Arabia. These people have a lot to lose. They're showing true courage. Don't forget, and this is important to remember, don't forget, says Andy, Egypt is a rendition stop-off point for the CIA. Andy adds, Jim doesn't get it. Mubarak is a despot, a pure anti-democratic tyrant. He broaches absolutely no dissent, none. You don't stay in office for 30 years unless you're absolutely brutal. Look what happened to Ayman Nour, the constant in and out of jail for speaking out. Mubarak jails any political dissent. Vive la Revolution. I love to see the people rise up and stick it to the chamber. We need some of that here. But I don't think Andy would take issue with me saying it ain't going to happen here. Oh, correction. I got it wrong, Ron. No, not Lao Tzu, Sun Tzu. Lao was the father of Taoism. Yeah, Sun Tzu. Sun Tzu, the art of war. You know, sometimes when you just work off the cuff, you get those. But he's right. And doggone it, we got so close. I was looking forward to one night of the month when I could just say, leave the fundraising alone. But, not so much. We pulled up $40 short tonight. I thought sure we could get, we could do $90 worth of contributions in a show. But we didn't. But we're awfully close. So maybe that'll happen over the weekend. It probably will. And I'll still be able to shut up on Monday about it. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. You, with your ideas and your conversation and your contributions of all sorts. There would be no conversation radio without you. Thanks to Lottie in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Our op-ed correspondent, Reverbo, Cavalcade of Crazy. Our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne. My head writer, David in Tennessee. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer, producer, musician, show host, man about town. Seriously, thanks to John Fox. And thanks to Ben Birch, who, for 9 years now, beginning in 2002, with his establishment of WhiteRoseSociety.org, has literally made it possible for liberal talk to flourish on the Internet. Wow, huh? Yeah. Thanks, Ben. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. They exhibit that bravery every day, and you hear about a good bit of it right here. If you haven't been by Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, take a trip by and just take a look at the work. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.